Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hej och välkomna till Vinpratarna. Idag har vi ett litet specialavsnitt. Vi har en till amerikan här, Jimmy Hayes from California. And you brought the Californian sun to Stockholm.
It's beautiful.
We're very happy that you are here. So Andreas is not here today, but I will conduct this interview. So welcome to Stockholm.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm wonderful. It's my first time here.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing place, and I've met wonderful people. The weather is beautiful, and I can't wait for today.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about yourself. So you have been working at Mayakamas for how many years now?
So I've been working at Mayakamas since the middle, or since the beginning of 2014.
So 2 years?
Yeah, two and a half years or so at this point. And I started there after the new owners had taken over the winery. It's a long history, but our history there is reasonably short. And I've lived in the Napa Valley for coming up on 10 years.
It's a good place to live.
Yeah, it's a great place to live. And I've been in the wine business for quite a while.
So before you moved to Napa, so that's 10 years ago, where did you live then?
I'm from New York, born and raised just outside the city, and I'd been working in the restaurant industry in New York City for quite a while before that.
So how did it start? What was your first job?
Well, gosh, my first job, I think everybody has an interesting way to start in restaurants. I started, I guess, if we go all the way back to the beginning, I started as a short order cook at a pool, like a pool at a country club, making, you know, tuna melts and the hamburgers and things like that. It was a summer job and it was a lot of fun. But really, for the restaurant industry, for me, it started when I was at college in New Orleans, Louisiana. Quite honestly, I loved living in New Orleans. It's a very fun city in the States, and I wanted to get a little extra money to buy beer when I had some free time. So I started working as a back waiter, you know, kind of a busboy at Emeril Lagasse's restaurant called Delmonico.
Good place to start.
Yeah, really good place to start. And I never expected that it would be something important that I was doing in my life, but it instantly set me on a track. And I knew after maybe a week working, serving bread and serving water, that was what I wanted to do with my life.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So after New Orleans, did you go back to New York?
I was on my way to New York, and I worked in New Orleans for a little while, and then I went to Colorado for a couple of years and worked in an apprenticeship position there at a restaurant, not in Aspen or in one of the big fancy towns, but in Colorado Springs, and then back to New York City. And my arrival in New York City was unremarkable. I tried my best to find a great place to work, and I remember I took out the Zagat Guide, back when it was actually a book. And I looked at, I made notes in the book of every important, exciting place that I wanted to work. And I made a mark, and I folded the pages down and dog-eared the pages. And I tried very hard to get myself into some kind of exciting restaurant. And I started working, you know, I had very little experience. I mean, you know, not certainly in New York City, they look for people that have worked in New York City before.
Yeah, sure.
But I started working at a restaurant called Union Pacific, which was, you know, a New York Times 3-star restaurant. It was a chef named Rocco DiSpirito who, you know, did some celebrity things, but also was a pretty amazing chef. This was his fine dining flagship restaurant. And I started working there, and I was a manager at the restaurant for a few years, and it was the first place that I ever really had the direct opportunity to work with wine. I'm a very persuasive individual,
okay.
And I'm the kind of guy that will sort of, if I need something to happen, I'm going to kind of poke you and poke you and poke you and say...
That's a good way, very effective.
Yeah, it ultimately gets the job done. Either really annoys people or it actually gets the job done, probably a little bit of both. So there was a guy there whose name was Fred Price, and he was the sommelier, kind of a classic New York guy. And, you know, he let me start helping him with the wine just a little bit. And you know, it's a very humble beginning. It was, you know, unpacking boxes and dusting off bottles and things like that. And but it's really kind of where it started.
So you learned by doing, didn't?
Yeah, very much so. I've never been a great student. But I've always been a good executor, and for me, learning has been all about, you know, getting my hands dirty and the practical element of doing the work. It's been my whole career has been that way.
So how long did you stay in New York then? So you worked.
So after that start, we sort of got information in New York that Thomas Keller was coming, and that was, for me, as a kind of a geeky restaurant guy, he was my idol.
Thomas Keller is coming.
Yeah, Thomas Keller's coming to New York, and it was at this point it was then 2003, and Per Se ultimately opened in 2004, the very beginning of 2004. But when I heard that Thomas was going to open a restaurant in New York, for me it became sort of a singular
mission.
Yeah. And, you know, back to the idea of
poking.
I sent my resume to the French Laundry twice a month for, I think, 5 or 6 months.
I love that.
Yeah. And I never, ever, ever got a phone call back until, gosh, just a couple days before the restaurant opened, before the training started. So, I went in for interviews, and it was a long process, talking to people, meeting everyone, and ultimately they said, well, what job would you like to do here at the restaurant? And I said, I'd like to be a sommelier. And they said, basically, well, we'll give you a job as a back server. So, you know, I had been that's where I started.
Yeah.
And I had, at that point, been working in restaurants for, you know, probably 5 years or something like that. And I had, you know, I was managing this, prestigious restaurant in New York. And my answer to the question was, if you'd offered me a job as a dishwasher, I would have said, thank you very much. And I would have accepted it. I just wanted to work for Thomas Keller because at that time in America, there was no one more important than Thomas, and his, you know, there was some mystique around him at that point as well. He wasn't as established as he is now. And the French Laundry was a restaurant I'd never gone to. And the reputation was, you know, just, it was absolutely sterling. And him deciding to open a restaurant like the French Laundry in New York, you know, where there's many, many great restaurants in New York, but that was the most interesting and exciting and new thing that had happened in New York for a very, very long time. And it was just a remarkable experience. So
I can imagine.
I started a couple days after the interview, and we trained for a very long time, and the restaurant was open for 7 days or 5 days or something like that, and then we had a fire that closed the restaurant for months. And
that's such a sad story.
It's an, you know, yeah. You know what? It's an amazing. It was an amazing opportunity. I think that we all need to find the good in things. And,
sure.
You know, it's if you look backwards, obviously that's always you know, the clearest vision. But you know, you open a restaurant, you've spent millions and millions of dollars to get it ready and make it perfect. Working actually in the space for 5 days will prove to you, will prove out all of these things that you didn't do right.
Yeah.
It's not because you're not smart or it's not because you're not prepared, but practical life gets in the way sometimes. So we had this amazing practice period, and then we realized that, you know, gosh, the restaurant's going to be closed for a long time. And a lot of things changed during that closure that hadn't, that wouldn't have changed had it, had the fire not happened.
So for the better in some cases. For the better.
Yeah, exactly. So it was kind of the, one of the greatest soft openings in the world, because then you had a chance to go back and sort of fix the restaurant after the restaurant had opened. It was an amazing experience. Per se was at that time, I don't know that there's a more, there was a more exciting restaurant anywhere, you know, probably in the world.
So you started in 03, and how long were you there for?
So I was at Per Se for 4.5 years.
4.5 years.
So the first, from, you know, from before opening day, for the first 4.5 years, the restaurant was open, and as I like to do, I needed to get to, you know, to the place that I wanted to be professionally at Per Se.
Yep.
And I started as a back server, and through my poking and through my work, I became a captain, and then I became a sommelier, and then I became the maitre d', and then I became the chef sommelier, and ultimately, after 4.5 years, I only left Per Se to go to California to be the corporate wine director for the restaurant group. So, it was an ascent, and
yeah,
it took a lot of time and effort and hard work. But it's the sort of company where good work brings you places.
And that's the kind of companies you want to work for, where you can evolve. And
well, yeah, I think so. I think that my father, who's a person I have a lot of respect for, who was a businessman, he was in publishing and magazines. You know, he worked for one company for almost 40 years. And I remember the advice that he gave me at that time was, you know, I asked him, you know, there's this great company that I want to work for, and it's, you know, it's the best restaurateur in America, and but the job is not that interesting. I'm going to be a back server again. And he said, don't choose the job, choose the organization, because
yeah,
the organization will take you, if it's a good one, where you need to go. And he couldn't have been more right.
Wise words.
Yeah, very wise words.
So then you moved to California to work for the whole
yep,
restaurant
mm-hmm,
company.
Yep. So my mentor was his name is Paul Roberts, and he's a master sommelier. He's one of the great people in wine in America. He now works for Colgan Cellars, and Paul had been the wine director for the company, and he was, you know, he had set everything up at Per Se, and then ultimately he left the company to go work before he was at Colgan. He was at Harlan, and he
good places.
Yeah, he likes to go to the best places.
Yeah,
So it was there was a void to fill, and man, I mean, Per Se was an incredible place to work, and you know, maybe the only thing I would ever change about my job in my career is going back and working there longer, just because I liked it so much.
Yeah, sure.
But he opened when he left, it opened a void that was just too compelling to fill. To be invited to the Napa Valley to work and affect all the restaurants in the group was, you know, I couldn't say no to that. So we packed up, and my wife, who is as much of a New Yorker as anyone I've ever met in my life,
yeah,
moved to California, and she was 37 when we moved out there, and she'd never driven a car in her entire life. And I made the bad
big change.
Made the bad mistake of trying to teach her how to drive a car, which I wouldn't recommend to anyone. They ever try to teach their spouse anything as important as driving a car. But
mm-hmm,
yeah, we went west, and I miss everything about New York except living there. It was very hard to leave per se, but then, you know, it had been a long time dream to go and be at the French Laundry and be a part of the French Laundry, which is, you know, such an important restaurant for American cuisine in general. And yeah, sure enough, snap your fingers and drive across the country and you're there.
Yeah, and Mayacamas is an amazing estate, an amazing place to be at. Yep. As well.
Yep.
Can you tell us a little bit about the vineyards and a little bit about the history of Mayacamas?
Sure. Absolutely. You know, choosing great organizations is has always been a theme, and the only other thing I've done between Thomas Keller and Mayacamas was working for an estate called the Araujo Estate.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's really, truly one of the great Cabernets in America and one of the great, terroirs for Cabernet anywhere probably in the world, the Isley Vineyard. And I started working there after my wife and I started our family, and the only reason I left restaurants was really to be, you know, home more. And worked with the Isley Vineyard and Araujo for 3.5 years, and then that property sold. Nearly at the same moment that Mayacamas had sold to a new owner, right in the middle of 2013. And the opportunity to work at Mayacamas was, gosh, you know, it's just one of the most amazing properties and stories in California, and it was at the end of a cycle. And the person that had owned the property for almost 50 years, his name was Bob Travers. And Bob was, you know, he is a legendary winemaker. He's one of the really most important unsung heroes of winemaking in America. He was the vigneron at Mayacamas for 45 straight vintages. And it was, you know, from the time he was 30 until the time he was 75, it was his life's work. And you know, unapologetically traditional winemaker, you know, very early harvest, you know, very firm mountain wines, and you know, through the periods of time in the 90s and 2000s when Napa wine became all about ripeness and richness and, you know, sort of
chasing the bricks.
chasing the bricks and chasing the points. He didn't I don't know if he didn't get the message that was what was happening.
Mayacamas is so hidden. It's too far away.
It is very far away. Or maybe he just didn't care. But he always made his wine the way that he made it. And because it, ironically, I guess you'd say, never evolved, it has become totally unique. And in Napa Valley, there's so many amazing properties, but there's nothing else like Mayacamas. It's 500 acres. Excuse me. On the top of a mountain, and the history is unparalleled. And to be able to come in to this thing and be a part of its rejuvenation, and to take it to the next, and you know, arguably most important period in its life, it's like a fairy tale. I mean, it's a fantasy. I pinch myself all the time, and every one of us that work there do the same thing. It is. Truly one of the most important stories in the Napa Valley in the history of Californian and American wine. And, you know, to put my name on a list, you know, along with Charles and his partners, the owners, and Andy Erickson, the winemaker, to put our name on a list with Bob Travers, sure, but the people that owned it before Bob Travers, the Taylor family. Bob Sessions was the winemaker through the late 60s and early 70s. Philip Tony was the winemaker there.
Yeah.
And Bruce Nyers. Incredible people that are icons in our industry, and people that I, you know, long before I started working at Mayacamas, you know, considered heroes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable, you know, to be carrying on their legacy.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the change that's been going on.
So,
that
was a long-winded answer to your question. Tell us a little bit about
the long
vineyards,
answers.
which I didn't actually say anything about. So, it is a 475, 80-acre parcel on the top of Mount Veeder. It has about 50 acres of vineyard.
So, Mount Veeder, if you would locate it on the Napa Valley map.
Yep, so it's the most southwest appellation in Napa.
Yep.
So we're in the Mayacamas Mountains, which are on the western side of the valley. But it's the first mountain in the range.
Yep.
So it's just above the city of Napa. If you look south, we're bordered by Carneros. West, the town of Sonoma. East, the town of Napa.
Yeah.
And it's very high elevation, so it's from, you know, about 600 meters at the lowest.
No fog.
Elevation to 800 meters. Yeah, we're above, every morning we're above the fog. And it makes for an interesting climate for growing grapes. We don't have the sort of hot, long sun that they have in some of the other Appalachians in the valley farther north, like St. Helena, Calistoga, Oakville, where we're much more marginal climate. So it's warmer in the mornings, which is nice, but then most of the day it's cooler, and it makes for a long growing season. So the wines from Mount Veeder in general are kind of, you know, if people like sexy Napa wine, Mount Veeder's, of all the Appalachians in the valley, probably the last place you'd like to go make that kind of wine. It's cool. We have wines that are driven by acidity and wines that have very firm mountain tannins. And you know, mountain wines are always known to be rugged, but we're like a cool mountain. So we're sort of rugged and lean and very, very classic in style for an Appalachian. You know, one of the great things about Mayacama is that I've always loved about the wine is that it really celebrates the Appalachian. It doesn't try to fit a popular style. It doesn't try to fit, you know, the average consumer's expectation of what a Napa Valley wine is. It is a wine of its place. And obviously that's sort of a simple idea for wine, but it's a really important one.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So with the new owners, what was their goal and aim? They wanted to change... Not change the wine, obviously, but make it better, I guess.
I think that's the most simple and important idea of what, you know, what the future holds and what the last 3 years have held for Mayacama. It's there's a story that is so much longer than any of us. I mean, Mayacama was founded in 1889. It's 130 years almost at this point. And we don't want to be the ones that come in and change everything about the style, change everything about the place, to sort of reduce it down to a simple idea that's you know, powerful and important one for us, is we want to do the same thing better. So the 3 years has been busy at Mayacama. We inherited a place that was, you know, starting to be in need of some, how do we say it?
A lift,
A little facelift, and you know, it had not seen a lot of investment for a few decades before we got there. So the wines were always great. The wines were, you know, were always the focus, but there was a lot of opportunity for us to improve the place, improve the facilities, and ultimately the wine that comes from those facilities. So it was a lot of restoration. of the grounds, of the winery, but it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was a renovation. I wouldn't say a lot changed. We've really tried to, you know, take every tool from the past, whether it's, you know, these old cinder block cement fermenters from the 1950s or the old winery from the 19th century. You know, we're not trying to make these sort of part of the past. We want them to be a part of the future. So we've done everything we can to fix them up and make them usable again. And it's been a great success. So we like the style of the wines. It is, you know, kind of like I said, they're classic mountain wines. They're not super dark, super fleshy Napa cabs like people understand. They're very much like wines from the old world, I think. Mm. They're higher in acidity, they're firm tannins, they age for decades and decades. And everything we've done with this restoration, renovation of the winery is designed to be able to make that same kind of wine more consistently on into the future. And our winemaker Andy Erickson is a magician, you know, in the cellar, and he has achieved the goal. I mean,
can you tell me a little bit about Andy?
Yeah, sure. Andy is a very close friend of mine, and a winemaker who, at this point, I think, you know, it would be hard to argue there are many people that are more successful in the Napa Valley than Andy. He's technically a consultant for us, and he's a consultant for a few other wineries as well. Currently, it's Dalla Valle, another one of my favorite properties, yeah, in Napa, Ovid, Arietta. He makes his own family wine called Favia.
Oh, beautiful, fantastic.
Yeah, for sure. Beautiful wine called Leviathan as well. And Andy has worked with our owner, Charles Banks, for many, many years on different projects around the world, really. When Charles is well known for being the guy that, with a partner, bought Screaming Eagle from Gene Phillips, right, the original founder, back in the mid-2000s. And Andy was the guy he hired to be the winemaker there. So he makes modern Napa wines, but what I think is so great about Andy as a consultant who works at multiple properties is that he's very sensitive to the needs of the particular place. Okay. He's the guy you hire, I think, to tell your story, not the guy you hire for his own story, if that makes any sense at all.
It does.
So when you taste Andy's wines from different properties, you can see very clear definition between them all. It's not an Andy wine. It's a really well-made wine from a very specific place. Dalla Valle tastes very different than Ovid, as they should, because they're from different places. And Maya Camas, you know, is nothing like any of the wines that Andy has made or any of us have ever worked with before from a winemaking and style perspective. And he's proven his ability and talent by his flexibility with the style, because everybody from day one has been saying, we can't really change the style. We don't want to change the style. We just want to make these wines better. And, you know, that's a really big, in the winery, that's a huge difference in method from any of the other stuff that any of us have worked with before.
So, if I've never tasted Maya Camas wines before, what should I expect, mm-hmm, both with the Chardonnay and the Cab?
Yep.
I think a lot of people have a view of what Napa taste like, mm-hmm, but what should I expect?
Well, our Chardonnays are not buttery, oaky Chardonnays. They're crisp in style. They're rich. Obviously, Chardonnay should always be rich, but they're not rich because of winemaking or, you know, sort of add-ons in the cellar. We have beautiful grapes that we get, and we just try our best to interpret the place they come from, and the wine that results is a pretty unique style. So they're intense, rich Chardonnays you know, that are very floral. They're very driven by, you know, kind of pear flavors instead of apple flavors, and they sort of present more like old world Chardonnay, I think, on the palate than
and age very well, right?
They do, yeah.
I tried the 08 yesterday, and it was so pure and youthful.
Yeah, it was in good shape. So they're one thing we hear a lot about our Chardonnay is that, you know, I hear people constantly say, "Oh, I don't like Chardonnay, but I like this," and I like to hear that. Yeah. That's exciting. So, I mean, the Cabernets are, you know, 2/3 of our production is Cabernet, and that's really the most important wine that we make. And, you know, I think, you know, at dinner last night, we had a lot of, you know, very classic Italian wines. And,
yep.
And I think that my Camus Cabernet has a lot in common with really classic Italian wines and really classic French wines, more so than it does the typical modern Napa Valley Cabernet. So we don't pick the grapes when they're super ripe.
When do you usually pick?
Yeah, usually the last couple of years we've had everything picked in before September was over.
Okay.
So there are people that pick all through October, and sometimes there are people that pick in November.
Yeah.
And that isn't what happens at Mayacamas. We want the flavors in our the flavors of classic Mayacamas wines are reflective of the earlier stages of ripeness for Cabernet. So it's not deep black flavors. They're red, taut, you know, tangy, fresh flavors of Cabernet that are herbal and that's what we do. So that's one of the most important things about the wine is harvesting it very early. And then, you know, the resulting wine is one that is, you know, it's an expression of certainly the place, but also of our winemaking style. We choose to do every, you know, this idea of uninterventionist winemaking is, you know, every choice, whether it's to do something or to not do something, is a choice, and you are intervening with everything you do or don't do. And, you know, our winemaking is classic winemaking that's designed to produce wines that taste this way. We choose to harvest early. We choose to ferment the wines quickly so that they're not super extracted and super sexy. And then when we age the wines, they're going into these truly incredible, the cellar that we work in is from the 19th century.
It's a beautiful cellar.
Yeah, this is the problem with podcasts and videos. Yeah. You can't show pictures or
I might have it. Some you pictures have, I can post. Yeah,
yeah, for sure. You've seen the place. But the wines age for a long period of time in neutral, large format oak foudre. So 600
and that's
gallons.
Not really common in Napa. Right.
No, not at all. It was common back in the 60s and the 70s, but it's not. It's basically something. It's a method that the Napa Valley has moved away from, almost completely, in lieu of sort of smaller, newer oak barrels.
Sure.
From our perspective, we're harvesting grapes that aren't super ripe. They're not. They don't really benefit from that addition of
new oak.
It's kind of a flavor battle. It's something that we found in our first vintage, 2013, as the winemakers. We did some experiments. We didn't just start doing everything exactly the same way that the previous owner had been doing. We tested out some new stuff, and
okay. You
know, it didn't really work. The idea of harvesting grapes early, when they aren't super ripe, and then putting them right into new oak barrels, like is pretty common in the Napa Valley, it absolutely was unsuccessful. So we aged the wines for a long time in these beautiful neutral foudres that we inherited that have been there. You know, Mr. Travers, the owner before us, he inherited many of them from the previous owners. They've been there since the 40s. Some of them are from the 1920s. There's a couple redwood vessels. A lot of them are American oak from, you know, foudres produced in Ohio, and then there's a lot of French oak from aging vessels as well. So after the wine spends a lot of time in neutral oak, 2 years, we'll do the assemblage. We'll blend the wine. All the components go together. We make the final blend, and then we'll put it into small oak barrels for a third year of wood aging, and that's where we can use a little bit of new wood, and that's where it makes sense for us to use a little bit of new wood, but it's only about 10%. So, you know, if a typical Cabernet from the Napa Valley is, you know, 50 to 100% new oak for 2 years, and that's pretty standard, I guess you'd say, we're, you know, 3 years of oak aging, but, you know, what it works out to is really less than 10% new oak. So it's a pretty pure expression.
And you grow some Merlot as well?
Yep. We make a little bit of Merlot. It's just at this point a few hundred cases, and we're actually growing that production in the future as well. It's not the most popular grape in America, thanks to
thanks to
hilarious
Sideways.
Movie, which
it's a good movie still. We love
so
it.
So many funny ironies in that movie about that Merlot comment. But it actually had a huge effect on...
That's so strange.
Yeah, Merlot in America. But so we inherited the winery with Merlot, Pinot Noir, and Sauvignon Blanc as part of the production. And we've decided not to continue Sauvignon Blanc and not to continue Pinot. And we thought really hard about making Merlot in the future and, you know, tasted all the wines back to the early 90s when they started making the wines. Ultimately settled on the idea that it's really good and it's really unique, and there's nobody else in America that's making Merlot like this, period. So we decided to continue and actually double down and make more of it in the future. It's a beautiful, beautiful wine. Obviously, Merlots are juicy and forward, and, you know, that's what we love about good Merlot. But a lot of times from California, they don't really resolve. They don't have good finish, firm, you know, acidity. They kind of lose it on the finish, and they're a little bit flabby and fat. And one of the things that we love about the wine is that it finishes very, very strong and very pure and really just sort of an intense mineral finish to it. So it's a lot like Merlot that you'd find from Italy or France.
Okay, so today is 2010.
Yeah.
That is available in Sweden. How long should you wait for that wine if you need some, like, ballpark? How many years?
We tasted that wine yesterday, and
it's delicious.
One of the great things about Mayacamas is that, you know, if you like our style of wine, you know, which a lot of folks do, you can drink it young. I mean, you can have it, you can taste it, and get a lot of pleasure from it now. But the other benefit is that it will cellar for, and, you know, this isn't an exaggeration. This is based on the wines that we have from the cellar from the past. We have a Cabernet Vertical back to the mid 1960s. You know,
good library.
Good library. And none of the wines from the late 60s on until the current vintages, I would say, are close to too old to drink. I mean, these are wines that will cellar for 30, 40, 50 years. I mean, it's almost effortless. It's part of the real benefit of making the wine that we make it. They'll do an amazing job of aging in the cellar, and they don't just get older; they get better, which are two totally different things.
That's very cool. Thank you, Jimmy, for having this conversation with me. I was actually flipping through your Instagram account yesterday, and you're a great photographer.
Oh, thank you.
Is that another passion of yours?
That's my secret other life. Yeah. I have a complete addiction to my camera and taking photographs of everything. You know, one of the most fun things that I do in my life is I've figured out a way to sort of have photography be, you know, a part of my professional life. So, you know, when I'm not up at the vineyard and I'm not, you know, conducting business in Stockholm for my Thomas, or even sometimes when I am, I'm shooting photographs, and I do a lot of photography for the wine industry, which has become just an amazing part of my life. You know, photojournalism, documenting harvests, documenting the year and the life of a winery, is something that a lot of people in the Napa Valley need and are interested in, and they're very excited to have somebody help them do it that doesn't just understand what looks pretty, but actually understands what's happening in the cellar and the cool details of harvest, not just the sort of, you know, pretty imagery that comes from it, but actually the process. So
if our listeners want to see your photos, where can they do that?
Well, Instagram, which is probably where the most photographs are, is Too Many Jimmys, T-O-O, Many Jimmys. We're all named Jimmy in my family.
There's a lot of Jimmys. Yeah. I was Googling Jimmy Hayes, and you know there's an ice hockey player also.
Yeah,
a good one.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes I tell people that's me, but they and then my photograph or my website is jbhphoto.co.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks,
and cheers.
Yeah, cheers.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.